Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, March 20th. I'm Lauren Schmidt reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, McKinleyville resident freed after 6.5 years as a hostage. Conflicting causes of Phillipsville slide could exclude district from FEMA funding. And PG&E announces it will permanently reduce flows from Lake Pillsbury and hints at expedited removal of Scott Dam. Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. A McKinleyville man who was held hostage in Niger since 2016 has been released. Jeff Woodkey was living in the West African country as a Christian missionary and aid worker, but was kidnapped from his residence over 6.5 years ago. The U.S. and Nigerian governments have long suspected that jihadists have held Woodkey since then. Last year, his wife, Els Woodkey, addressed the press in this interview.
Well, thank you for the opportunity for me to discuss the situation of my husband, Jeff, who was kidnapped from his residence in Abolak, Niger, on October 14, 2016. Some men drove to his house in the early evening in a small pickup truck, got out, killed both of Jeff's guard, and forced Jeff into the truck at gunpoint. The truck was followed for a while by Jeff's neighbors, but was last seen driving into the night north towards the Malian border. Now, more than 5 years later, he remains a hostage held by jihadists somewhere in the Sahel.
It was not sustainable to have that many people going out with their herds and living the nomadic lifestyle. So Jeff was helping people to find fixation points. So to that end, he would dig wells, he would build schools, he organized grain banks, things like that, just to help people have a place that they could call home.
We started building a subterranean dike, and what that is basically a regular dike is above ground, subterranean, under the ground. We do this so that when the rains come, the water doesn't just move out of the area, it stays, which allows us the natural grasses to grow for the animals.
He had animal lending programs, basically an old herding practice that Fulanis and Tuaregs used to do, where they would lend animals to each other, and then basically the animals would have offspring, and they could keep the offspring or give the offspring back and keep the main animal, vice versa. The point is, it was a system of exchange.
My dad had really good relationships with a lot of the people out there, especially with the Wadabe and the Keltamajik people. He did invest a lot of time in learning the languages. He was almost fluent in Keltamajik.
If I would describe Jeff in one word, I would say dedicated. Dedicated to God, dedicated to his family, and dedicated to the work he felt God has called him to minister to the nomads of Niger. When Jeff was kidnapped, I and the boys, we were in McKinleyville, California. Jeff felt it was safer for us to stay here.
It hasn't been good, but I mean, it's like a constant thing that you have in the back of your head all the time.
Earlier this Monday morning, Els Woodkey confirmed that her husband is free after 6.5 years of captivity in West Africa. In a post to social media, she stated that she had not yet heard from Jeff, but has been told that he is in good condition. She expressed profound thanks to many people in the government and others around the world who have worked hard to see this result. National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby has told the press that Woodkey will be reunited with his family following a full medical check. KMUD News will continue to share updates. A statement from the Humboldt County Office of Emergency Services could exclude a rural southern Humboldt water district from FEMA funding. Lisa Music reports.
Residents near Ascending Lane in Phillipsville were evacuated last Friday, March 17th, due to the threat of a mudslide. Bonnie Mullaney, general manager of Phillipsville Community Services District, discovered a massive water loss due to a broken main on the district's 140,000-gallon tank on the east side of the Avenue of the Giants on the day prior.
On Thursday, I drove down the road. An hour later, I came back, and within that time frame, 100,000 gallons of water had come out of a pipe that had been pulled apart from a 6-inch drop in the land. It was 6 inches apart and 6 inches below, and at a different angle than the pipe that was coming out from the top part of the hill. We had to put a temporary fix in. We also put a flexible line so that if it does move again, it will have some room to pull. It did create a tiny slide on my road from 100,000 gallons in an hour coming out, but that is not what caused the ground to drop and separate the pipe. The next day, there was two cracks in the road below where the pipe had separated, and that wasn't there the first day. When I saw that those cracks, that made me realize it's bigger than just that isolated area where the leak was.
When Mulaney realized that the slide was actively moving and larger than originally thought, she notified nearby residents and contacted Humboldt County Office of Emergency Services. Red Cross was also notified, and a shelter for displaced residents was set up at Stevens Hall in nearby Miranda. Today, March 20th, residents remain displaced as engineers inspect the approximately 3-acre area that is in jeopardy of sliding as rain is forecasted.
So today, Ryan from OEA and a guy named John, who is another geoengineer who works for the state, they came down, and the two engineers pretty much said all the same things. You know, they looked at the cracks. Today we're filling in the cracks to make sure that no water gets in this next rain. We're just going to pack them full, and we can also monitor the growth easier that way.
Mulaney issued a boil water notice for Phillipsville CSD customers under the direction of the state's Division of Drinking Water after notifying the agency of the situation. The boil water notice remains in effect, though test results tomorrow should give Mulaney a clearer picture of when the notice will be lifted.
Tomorrow, if our tests come back good, then we get to lift the boil water notice.
In addition to issues surrounding the repairs of the separated pipes and boil water notice, this incident has highlighted the district's need to have savings for emergent events, something that may mean a rate raise for Phillipsville CSD customers.
We don't have a lot of money in our bank account because we try not to have too high of rate. You know we have a low-income area. Unfortunately, we are probably going to have to raise our water rates because we have to be prepared for events like this. I'm just concerned financially because we're going to have to put the money out first for any work that's done and then get reimbursed.
Earlier today, local news partner Redheaded Black Belt reported that a spokesperson for Humboldt County OES stated, quote, "The slide itself was caused by the water main burst. This caused the slope to become unstable." End quote. However, the spokesperson updated us after speaking with OES's Ryan Derby, stating, quote, "At this point, the causation of the slide is undetermined. The water main break certainly exacerbated the slide. However, it's hard to say which came first." That being said, there is no timeline for lifting the evacuation order as more rain is in the forecast. The order will remain in place until after the weather system passes through, and then a geologist will again inspect the area. End quote. If the slide was caused by the burst water main, the district and the residents would be excluded from FEMA funding. Mulaney believes there may be some confusion in information between the site and officials in Eureka.
I know that it wasn't caused by the water line, and there was two geologists that were there. They agree, and they can see where it happened, that the land dropped, and that is what separated the pipe. And I know that the pipe wasn't leaking before this because we keep records of our tank level every day. So we looked at the tank level yesterday and in the, you know, the previous month, and you could see it's about 140 gallons per connection was being used a day. If there was a leak, it would have been a lot more than that.
Mullaney spent the day with two geologists who, she said, agreed that the slide is what caused the water main separation.
And that was one thing that the engineer said, is that if you look at the topographical map, right where the cracks are happening line up with where it shows, kind of, it's like a little part of a bigger slide of the whole hill. And, you know, it's Humboldt County. Most of our hills are potential slide zones. So it didn't really shock me. But the fact that the cracks line up with that, that did give him concern.
With the district's lines ran on unstable ground, the general manager says that even if the slide does not slip out, upgrades will need to be made to the water line that lie within the slide area.
We're going to have to come up with a permanent solution. Right now, it's just a temporary fix. We may want to run the water line at a different route because we don't want it to be necessarily in the same spot that is potentially moving for the future. We also want to look into putting an earthquake line, which means it expands a little bit. It's more flexible.
We will be following up on this story and the displacement of residents in the upcoming days. For KMUN News, I'm Lisa Music.
PG&E, which owns and operates the Potter Valley Hydropower Project, informed regulators that it will not open the spillway gates on Scott Dam in Lake County. Sarah Reith reports.
PG&E has signaled strongly that it's considering the expedited removal of Scott Dam due to seismic concerns, according to a news item in an industry publication yesterday. In the meantime, the spillway gates at the top of the dam will remain open. This will cause Lake Pillsbury in Lake County to be 10 feet or 26% lower than it normally is heading into spring. According to the PG&E article, with the dam gates remaining open, water availability will be similar to dry year conditions experienced in 2020 and 2021. PG&E owns and operates Scott Dam and Lake Pillsbury, which are part of the Potter Valley Hydropower Project, which diverts water from the Eel River into the Russian River. The utility is in the process of developing a plan to surrender the entire project. Early this afternoon, PG&E filed a document with FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, explaining that according to the results of a recent analysis, quote, proactive steps to limit the potential for seismic instability of Scott Dam are necessary at this time, including maintaining the lower water level. The filing states that according to a memo prepared by its engineering consultant on March 14th, the proposed restriction will improve the dam's expected stability and safety performance during a major earthquake. Alicia Heyman is the executive director of Friends of the Eel River, an environmental group that's questioned the seismic safety of the Potter Valley Project for years. That information is secret due to laws about the confidentiality of infrastructure vulnerabilities.
We've been raising concerns about Scott Dam's location next to Bartlett Springs Fault, about the active landslide on the southern abutment of the dam, about the knocker, that giant boulder that sits right behind the dam and is the reason that Scott Dam has that really unusual sharp angle in its construction. It's really, frankly, kind of validating to see PG&E and FERC starting to take these concerns seriously.
Elizabeth Salamone is the district manager for the Russian River Flood Control and Water Conservation Improvement District, a water wholesaler and a leading water manager for the Upper Russian River in Mendocino County.
The news is devastating for the Mendocino County Russian River watershed. We're likely to feel impacts of these changes in the Eel River to the Russian River transfers, even in a year like this one. The upper portion of the Russian River is reliant on Lake Mendocino, which is a reservoir that does not hold enough storage to see us through extended drought periods. It needs to refill every winter to meet historical water use levels, and that doesn't account for carryover in case there is a dry winter.
PG&E has not submitted a plan to remove the dam at this point, but it's already planning to submit a variance request to manage the flows out of Lake Pillsbury to keep the levels low. The utility expects a minimum flow of 5 to 25 cubic feet per second to the east branch of the Russian River, which flows into Lake Mendocino. The Potter Valley Irrigation District has a separate contract with PG&E for its water. The Irrigation District's Janet Polly said a lot of uncertainty remains, but she's expecting this year's grapes to make it through the cold.
As far as I know, and from what I've been told today, for sure we'll be able to access our frost protection water this spring, which of course is critically important. The way the frost protection works on our contract with PG&E is we request it. We don't get just a certain block of water. So if we have an indication that there's going to be frost protection needed, we have to contact Pacific Gas and Electric so that we can get delivered the number of cubic feet per second we think we need to fill ponds so that we're capable of frost protecting the next night or the next three nights or whatever it is. And that's been in place for quite a long time. What's going to happen with our summer water supply? It has yet to be determined.
Charlie Schneider is the Lost Coast Project Manager for California Trout, which has long advocated for the full removal of the Potter Valley Project, including Cape Horn Dam and Van Arsdale Reservoir in Potter Valley. One of the project's mitigation measures is releasing cold water for salmon from the bottom of the Lake Pillsbury Reservoir into the Eel River. Though Schneider says the habitat below the dam does not make up for the habitat behind the dam, which is inaccessible to the fish.
Caltrout's main concern, and those of us that care about the Eel River's main concern, is to make sure that this obsolete project that's kind of falling apart now is still able to take care of the fishery and manage its impact on the Eel River in that interim period before, you know, the project's decommissioned. So we want to make sure that the ultimate outcome here is dam removal, which is going to benefit the river and the fishery. But in that interim period, we want to make sure we're not killing all the fish, you know, between now and when we can get the dams out. So we're operating in this interesting gray area now between how the projects operated the last 50 years and, you know, this future, which is post-decommissioning.
The next to the last sentence of PG&E's article about keeping the spillway gates open is far from definitive. It reads, the company plans to continue to develop long-term mitigation measures which could include expedited partial or full removal of Scott Dam. Heyman is focusing on the possibility of things moving fast.
I'm a bit of an eternal optimist, and so the key word that I hone in on in that sentence is expedited.
Salamon is not quite as optimistic about the expedited nature of the much-reduced flow, which is a certainty with the spillway gates staying open as long as the dam is in place.
One proposal that's been put forward is the removal of Scott Dam and then continuing with what we call the run of the river, or what would be wintertime transfers from the Eel to the Russian River. And with that, there was an understanding that we would need to reduce our reliance on those summertime Eel River diversions and eliminate them eventually, if that was the option that happened in the future. But that was in the future. We thought we had some time to turn the bus around on this. And now we're finding, dramatically, we do not have time.
Reporting for KMUD, I'm Sarah Reif.
The first Land Back Symposium will be held on March 24th at Cal Poly Humboldt in cooperation with Save California Salmon. Speakers will include Dr. Kutcha Risley-Balding, the Department Chair of Native American Studies at Cal Poly Humboldt, WIAT Chairman Ted Hernandez, Wade Crowfoot, California's Natural Resource Secretary, Geneva Thompson, the Assistant Secretary of Tribal Affairs, among others with the Yurok, Karuk, and WIAT tribes. Panel discussions will include public and private land return, land grab universities, indigenous land trust, and funding land back. Today is the final day to register for the Northern California Land Back Symposium, which will take place in person and via Zoom this Friday. Here is Dr. Kutcha Risley-Balding, an organizer of the event, discussing land back, what it means, and why it's significant.
Just over 20 years ago, the WIAT people saw there was a small portion of their sacred island, Tulawat, for sale. Tulawat is located in Jarujiji, where you sit and rest, in what is currently called Eureka, California. It is the center of the WIAT world. It is a place of world renewal. And for over 100 years, it had been passed through ownership of various Humboldt County citizens, businesses, and finally, to the city of Eureka. The small parcel that was for sale was expensive for the small tribe who had survived attempted genocide, removal, relocation, and finally termination. WIAT territory in Humboldt County includes most of the most populous town centers. Eureka is known as the county seat and is one of the most populous towns in the region. And in the region, we often refer to Eureka as the city. It's where the Costco and the Target are. The WIAT saw purchasing the small parcel for sale as a return to the center of the world, and one of their spiritual leaders, Cheryl Seidner, began bake sales and t-shirt sales and outreach so that they could raise enough money to purchase just some of their land back. In our area, Tuluwat has most commonly been referred to as Indian Island. This is because on February 26, 1860, Humboldt County citizens massacred more than 150 Wiat people who had just finished their world renewal ceremony to pray for the health and well-being of the community and the world. Humboldt County citizens came with hatchets and knives. They murdered mostly Indian women and children. And this had been the last time the Wiat performed a world renewal ceremony on Tuluat. Until March 28, 2014, when the Wiat danced again, holding their first world renewal ceremony in over 150 years. And then this past year, October 2019, when the Wiat tribe had their island, their place of world renewal, returned to them from the city of Eureka. This was unprecedented. The joy in the room on that day when citizens from throughout Humboldt County gathered to celebrate the island's return to Wiat peoples was palpable. Wiat Tribal Chair Ted Hernandez stood before the room filled with hundreds of people, and while holding back tears, he spoke, quote, "This has been an intergenerational movement to heal the island, the health of our people, to heal our community. Today, we make history together. We change the story. Today is the day of pride for the city of Eureka. Today is Tuluat, the return of the Wiat people. Today, the Wiat people who have lived in this area since the time immemorial return to the center of their Wiat world. And we do this together with the city of Eureka," end quote. Today, I am here with you virtually from Wiat territory, very near Baduat, or what is currently called McKinleyville, California. I am Hupa Yorak and Karuk, and enrolled in the Hoopa Valley tribe. I grew up here in our Aboriginal territories, swimming in our rivers, gathering in our hills, eating acorns that my mother would take us to gather each year. She taught me how to gather, process, cook, and eat acorns. She told me about how at one time, federal government agencies proposed cutting down our oak trees so that they could stop us from eating acorns. It was profit to them. It was also a way to push us further from the connections to our land and our histories and our strong indigenous futures. We are nourished from the land and the land knows us. We introduce ourselves when we gather. We scatter tobacco and we say a prayer and we tell the land and trees and the plants and all of our more than human relatives, thank you for what they provide for us, for what they teach us throughout our lifetimes. According to the Sacred Land Film Project, Indigenous peoples are 4% of the world's population, live on 22% of the Earth's surface. And on that land is 80% of the planet's remaining biodiversity. The International Journal of Wildland Fire found that Indigenous cultural burning practices are some of the most beneficial for forest management. And they, quote, reduce fuel loads by 23 to 78% without changing the structure of the forest. And they decrease tree mortality, end quote. Research also shows that Indigenous peoples achieve conservation results at least equal to those of government-run protected areas, often with a fraction of the budget. I work to help people radically imagine what our decolonized futures can be. Because as Eve Tuck and K. Wayne Yang note, decolonization cannot be a metaphor. It is not about decolonizing our minds or our bookshelves or our syllabus or our garden. It is about the return of Indigenous land and life. It is about a world we build with relationship, reciprocity, and respect. It is at first hard to imagine. In our settler colonial capitalistic society, we haven't been given the space or the tools to imagine a world beyond settler colonialism and capitalism. I've heard scholars who point out that we have an easier time of imagining what we will do in a zombie apocalypse than we do imagining what the end of capitalism looks like. We believe these to be permanent structures, something that we cannot even imagine the world without. We aren't armed with tools to imagine a future beyond settler colonial logics like heteropatriarchy, dehumanization, terra nullius, and destruction of land, or the people and more than human relatives that live with us here. But in Indigenous cultures, we dream the world into being. It is our stories, our dreams, our songs, our late night conversations that build the world as it could be. Native peoples have been theorizing and using radical imagination for radical decolonized futures since the beginning of time. We have been given the tools to radically imagine how to build our futures. We dream them, we sing them, we story them into being. We have always done this, and we must begin again.
Today is the final day to register for the Land Back Symposium. You can register online at tinyurl.com/landbackreg. More information can also be found at californiasalmon.org/landback. Details are also posted on the KMUD News Facebook page. KMUD hopes to live broadcast portions of this event on Friday. In state news, detained immigrants in two California facilities mark 1 month of a hunger strike, demanding their release and better working and living conditions. KPFA's Rose Kaur shares this report.
Protesters gathered outside of the San Francisco Immigration and Customs Enforcement Field Office, also known as ICE. They chanted, sang, and meditated in support of the hunger strikers protesting the inhumane conditions at Mesa Verde ICE Processing Center in Bakersfield and Golden State Annex in McFarland, both owned by the private corporation GEO Group. Some are fasting in solidarity with the hunger strikers. The transfer of hunger strikers to the Mesa Verde Detention Center in El Paso sparked outrage, as the immigrants themselves, their attorneys, and loved ones were not notified until the event occurred. Through an amplified phone call, a witness describes the violent encounter as the hunger strikers were forced from their dorms.
I, myself, witnessed one of my peers being violently forced on the floor. He was yelling of pain, stating, "You are hurting me, you are hurting me, I am not resisting." While four GEO staff were twisting his wrists, hands, and placing their knees on his back and neck, this action was capricious and retaliatory. This traumatic event left us a deep wound.
Detention authorities said the transfers were for the safety of the detainees, an explanation that Emily Almendarez, a paralegal with Centro Legal de la Raza, disputes.
So they were transferred based on the context of, you know, for their medical safety, for their medical care. But if it's about safety, why would you, you know, retaliate against individuals? Why would you handcuff them, pepper spray them, put them on a bus, and then put them on a plane to a different state? It's not about safety, right? It's about control. It's about domination.
These retaliatory actions come on the heels of a class action lawsuit filed on February 23rd against the two detention facilities. The 82 detainees say they face ongoing harassment by the center's staff, including threats of solitary confinement, taunting with food, pressure to quit the strike, and suffering unbearably cold temperatures in the facilities. The hunger strike is an escalation of the immigrants' attempts to draw attention to inhumane living conditions, lack of medical care, and the $1 a day wage for 8 hours of cleaning and performing maintenance work in the facilities. Now the hunger strikers are demanding collective release of all detainees and that Mesa Verde and Golden State Annex close permanently. The hunger strike began February 17 with 84 hunger strikers from these two centers. Mesa Verde came under fire during the pandemic in the spring of 2020 when immigrants in Bakersfield held a hunger strike to protest lack of safety protocols, such as social distancing inside the overcrowded facility and inadequate cleaning supplies and sanitation. From San Francisco, I'm Rose Corr with KPFA.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez. And thanks to our reporters, Lisa Music, Sarah Reith, and Rose Corr. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Lauren Schmidt.